Hello, this is Margaret Cole. I hope that you'll like my new novel in the Wind River Mystery Series. Its title is Wife of Moon, and although it features Father John O'Malley, the pastor at St. Francis Mission on the Wind River Reservation, and Vicki Holden, the Arapaho attorney, the novel is quite different from others in the series. Wife of Moon is set both in the present and in the past, so that there are two stories separated by almost 100 years, yet connected. The past story takes place in October of 1907, when the famous photographer Edward S. Curtis visited the reservation to photograph the Arapaho people. I'm certain that you've seen examples of Curtis's incredibly beautiful and moving photographs of Indian tribes in the West. Photographs such as that of Chief Joseph, or Geronimo, or Navajos riding horses through the Canyon de Chelly, they're all part of our lexicon of the West. I became intrigued by a real mystery surrounding Curtis. Even though he had taken dozens, even hundreds of pictures of some tribes, he took only 11 photographs of Arapahos on the Wind River Reservation. He spent a brief time there and left abruptly. History does not tell us why. Well, mystery writers love nothing more than a good mystery. So I asked myself, what might have happened during Curtis's visit that made him pack up his cameras in his wagon and leave after having made so few pictures? I came up with a crime that might have occurred, a crime so heinous that it drove Curtis away, a crime that could reverberate into the present and lead to still other crimes, and that became the plot for Wife of Moon. I'm going to read the first chapter, which is set in October 1907, and then excerpts of the second chapter, set in the present with Father John O'Malley. Bigushish, the moon, literally night sun, from biga, night, and hishish, sun, or celestial luminary. From the Arapaho Glossary. There was a camp circle along the river. One night when moon was shining brightly, as were also all the stars, there were young women sitting outside enjoying the night breeze. One of them said that she wished very much that she could marry Moon. Of course, Moon heard the remark and immediately began to consider the course of events were he to marry a human being. Traditions of the Arapaho. Chapter 1, October 1907. The three warriors set their ponies against a glass-blue sky broken only by the mare's tail cloud streaming overhead. The Arapaho sun turned the wild grasses and underbrush gold and vermilion and sent tongues of fire leaping off the silver spears that decorated the harnesses. As the warriors started downslope, brown puffs of dust rose around them. The sun illuminated the white and blue stripes painted on the flanks of the ponies, marking them as war ponies. The warriors were painted too. Red, white, and yellow stripes ran across brown, naked chests and arms. White paint smeared their faces so that their eyes were like charcoal smudges behind white masks. They wore brown buckskin trousers fringed down the sides. Black hair hung long and straight over their shoulders, secured by headbands that held a single eagle feather. The warriors reined in and stared down at the village. Village! Jesse White Owl wanted to laugh out loud. A couple dozen canvas teepees dragged out of sheds where they'd been folded away for 30 years. The grandmothers had to show people how to erect the teepees because no one else remembered. Still, it had taken all day when, in the old time, the grandmothers had set up an entire village while the warriors unsaddled the ponies. It must be a traditional Arapaho village, Edward S. Curtis had said 3 days ago when Jesse guided him to Black Mountain, which the photographer had pronounced the perfect location. They dismounted and trudged across the flats at the foot of the slope, the photographer talking out loud, talking to himself, Jesse thought, picturing in his mind the images that he would capture. Curtis was a tall man, half a head taller than Jesse, with a thin frame and arms and legs that moved at angles. He had yellow hair and a yellow beard that jutted from the front of his chin. His eyes looked like pieces of blue glass caught in his pink face, reflecting the images all around him. He wore dark trousers and a white shirt, with a black string tie looped at the opened collar, and a light-colored slouch hat that threw the band of shadow across his forehead. "We'll set up the village here. The photographer had taken off his hat and waved toward the clumps of sagebrush and wild grasses. Then he'd swung around. "I'll set the camera on the tripod over there and take pictures of people in the village going about everyday chores, not knowing the enemy is coming." "They would know," Jesse had told the white man. "The guards would spot the enemy and warn the chiefs. The women and children would be sent from the village. When the enemy rode toward the village, the men would be ready." The photographer had waved his hat toward the mountain as if he hadn't heard. "First, a picture of the warriors riding down slope. Then pictures of the village, and then the attack." He'd set his hat back on his head and squinted into the sunlight, as if the images had already etched themselves in his eyes. "The pictures will document an attack on a peaceful village. Everyone will be shooting blanks, but the noise will sound like an actual attack." "There are no more villages," Jesse had told the photographer. "The people have lived on the Wind River Reservation for many years. In wood boxes," he'd been thinking, "except for one elder who refused to live in a log cabin. Human beings weren't meant to live in boxes made from trees," he said. So he lived in a buffalo hide teepee. At night, he led his pony into the box. Jesse had pushed on, explaining that Arapahoes lived like white people now. Farmers. He had his own allotment. 160 acres of rocks, brush, and hard, dry earth. He'd plowed the earth the way the agricultural instructor at Fort Washakie had said, planted hay and sold the crop in Casper, with enough left over to feed his horses over the winter. Sometimes he caught on with the freighters who drove wagon teams to Casper and brought back goods for the mercantile store in Arapaho. Last week, when he'd brought in a wagon load of flour, salt, sugar, and coffee to the store, he'd seen Curtis for the first time, talking to a group of Arapahoes, showing around the paper images he'd made of other tribes. He'd wanted to make images of Arapahoes, too, he said. He'd pay anyone willing to pose for him. And he needed an assistant, an Arapaho who could speak English, somebody willing to learn how to make images. There was a time when Jesse would have been reluctant to speak up. It was impolite to put yourself forward. But after 6 years at St. Francis Mission School, he'd absorbed the white ways along with the language, and he'd stepped over to the porch and said, "I can help you, sir." Now the photographer was waving his hat toward the warriors paused halfway up the slope. They nudged the ponies forward out of the half-shadow and into the light, and the photographer turned his attention to the village. It was as quiet as one of the images the photographer made on paper, Jesse thought. Not like a village in the old time, filled with shouts and laughter and the sounds of horses neighing in the corral. This was a village of ghosts. The men wore skin shirts and trousers, handed down from the ancestors, and brought out of storage from time to time for ceremonies. The women had on deerskin dresses, their brown arms flashing through the fringe on the sleeves, and beaded moccasins that poked past the fringe around the skirts. The hair was in braids, wrapped with red and yellow cloth, that hung down the fronts of their dresses. Most of the women hovered near the kettles slung over campfires, pink and blue flames licking the metal. Two women were scraping hides stretched between poles set upright in the earth, kettles holding nothing but water, and hides scraped years ago. The men looked out of place, out of time, sitting cross-legged on blankets, chipping stones into arrowheads, bending willow branches into bows. A woman was combing the long black hair of one of the men. "Gonna get my hair braided and wrapped in red cloth," he told the photographer, "just like the warriors used to do." Jesse figured the man wanted to make sure he'd look handsome in the pictures. Curtis was approaching Bashful Woman's teepee now, and Jesse made himself look away. He did not want to taste again the bitterness that welled in his throat each time he saw Bashful and Karsten Evans, the white man, driving a team of horses into Arapaho, Bashful on the wagon bench beside him, the child clutched to her. Jesse had opened a box of glass plates when, out of the corner of his eye, he saw Bashful dash past the photographer. He looked around, unable to ignore her any longer. His heart felt like a fist of lead in his chest. The child ran ahead on short, wobbly legs, trailing a toy that clinked over the ground. Bashful scooped up the child, kicking and laughing, and nuzzled her face against the small chest. The photographer ran forward, gesturing with his hat, his voice bursting like pellets from a shotgun. "No white toys in the village!" Jesse walked over, "My people were traders," he said to Curtis. "There were many things made by white people in the villages." But the white man waved away the explanation. The images would show the village that existed in his mind. Bashful pried the toy from the child's hand and gave it to the photographer. With back straight and head high, like the image of the woman that Jesse carried in his heart, the daughter of Chief Sharpnose, proud and beautiful, Bashful walked back to the teepee, dropped onto the blanket next to her husband, and cuddled the child in her lap. Karsten Evans did not lift his eyes to her. His gaze remained on the rifle in his hands. Yesterday, Evans had ridden into the photographer's camp just west of the village, dust swirling behind him. He'd reined in next to the supply wagon where Jesse had been organizing the bottles of chemicals and boxes of paper, wanting the portrait of Bashful and the child that Curtis made the day before, Jesse thought. He said, "The photographer's in the tent, still developing his images. Tell him we'll be in the village for the attack he's orchestrating." "No white men in the village." The white man had laughed at that. "White traders were always around. Took themselves Indian squaws." Jesse had hooked both hands in his belt to keep from pulling the man off his mount and smashing his face. So Bashful was a squaw, not an honored wife, the daughter of a chief. "We'll be there, Bashful and the girl and me," the white man said, turning the horse. The photographer was examining the Primo now. He ran a finger over the top of the bellows, then ducked under the black focusing cloth, his back curved into the camera. He looked like he had a wooden box for a head, the black lens for a single eye. He was framing the image he wanted and focusing on a spot one-third of the distance from the camera to the warriors, the farthest point in the picture, just as he taught Jesse. Then he would stop the lens down and adjust the shutter speed so that he could capture the images of the warriors attacking the village. "Give the signal," Curtis said, emerging from under the black cloth. Jesse stepped back to the supply wagon and took out the Winchester 73. Earlier, he'd loaded 10 cartridges in the rifle, each cartridge a blank filled with black powder and wads of cardboard. Pointing the muzzle to the sky, he pulled the trigger and fired. The loud report stopped up his ears for a moment. In a half second, other shots sounded from the bluff, the reverberations lost in the yells and shouts of the warriors as they galloped toward the village. The photographer pushed the plunger to make the image. "Stop," he yelled, and Jesse shot off another blank, then set the rifle on the ground. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the warriors rein in the ponies as he turned to the camera. He inserted the dark slide into the holder next to the exposed plate, then removed the holder. Working as fast and as carefully as he could, he handed the photographer one of the other holders that he'd also loaded earlier. Curtis pushed the holder into the slot behind the lens and pulled out the dark slide. Jesse picked up the rifle and fired again. The warriors broke into a gallop, bearing down on the village like a whirlwind that churned up the earth around the horses' hooves, howling into the volley of gunshots and the puffs of gray smoke that rose over the village. Curtis snapped the image. "Stop!" Jesse pulled the trigger again, but the noise of the gunshot was lost in the wall of noise falling all around. The warriors were galloping through the village as if they had entered another time and become the images the photographer intended to capture. The enemy attacking, compelled to go on and on until the village was reduced to ashes, with bodies strewn about and the wounded clawing their way around the dead. It was as if the people had also entered into that other time, as if they could sense the destruction crashing over them. Men ran toward the warriors, throwing up their palms in the sign of peace, trying to stop the attack. Other men pushed women and children into the teepees before dropping onto one knee, pointing rifles, spears, and bows and arrows in the direction of the warriors galloping past. Gunshots exploded in the air. "Wonderful, wonderful!" the photographer shouted. Jesse removed the exposed plate holders and slid other holders with new plates into the camera, all the time fighting back the urge to pick up the rifle, run to the village, and kill the enemy. They were firing blanks, he kept telling himself. It wasn't the true thing, only an image. Wasak! Shadows of the old world being captured on the glass plates. The photographer emerged from under the focusing cloth. "Success," he shouted. "I have caught everything." He clapped his hands overhead as if the sound would puncture the wailing and screaming, the rifle fire still bursting into the air. "Enough," he shouted. Then he started toward the village, waving his hat overhead. Jesse went after him. It was then that he saw the crowd flowing like water toward Bashful's teepee. He lunged around the photographer and broke into a run, darting through the waves of people, the images of shock and fear on their faces printing themselves in his mind. He was barely aware of the silence that was flooding the village, as if a river had jumped its banks and was inundating the earth. He pushed past Karsten Evans and stopped. He felt as if a bullet had slammed into his chest. Bashful lay on her side on the blanket, the child crawling close to her, grabbing at her with small brown hands, as if she were only resting after a busy day tending to her child and caring for her home. That was the truth Jesse wanted to see, not the truth that his eyes took in. In her back was a small hole, no bigger than a marble hole, but in her chest was a hole the size of a fist. The ground around the blanket was running red with her blood. The thin wail of the child cut like a knife into the silence. Jesse dropped down to his knees and stroked Bashful's silky black hair. "They killed her," Evans shouted above him. "They killed my wife." Chapter 2. A chill had settled over the evening, and moonlight shimmered in the frost that covered the grounds of St. Francis Mission on the Wind River Reservation. The moon was almost full, bright and low in the metallic sky pressing down over the earth. Most of the buildings around Circle Drive, the small white church with the steeple gleaming in the moonlight, the yellow stucco administration building, the two-story red brick residence, merged into the shadows of the cottonwoods that sheltered the grounds. But light glowed in the oblong windows of the two-story gray stone building that had once been the mission school, but was now the Arapaho Museum. Father John Aloysius O'Malley, the Jesuit pastor of the mission, zipped up his jacket and plunged across the grounds. He was a tall man, almost 6 feet 4 inches, and at 48 still retained the look of the athlete he'd been when he pitched for Boston College. He'd inherited the red hair, blue eyes, and quick smile that ran through his Irish family, and along with the freckles on his face and the laugh lines at the corners of his eyes, he had the strong features, high, intelligent forehead, and solid chin of a handsome man, although he'd never thought of himself as handsome. Even though he spent a few minutes looking at himself in the mirror every morning when he shaved, it had been years since he'd actually seen himself. He dipped his face into the collar of his jacket against the icy air that reminded him of Boston and home, a long way from the reservation that had been his home for the past 8 years. It could be a hard winter, he thought. The first frost coming so early, casting a silvery sheen over the brush and shrubs that had turned golden red with autumn. It was the second Monday in October, the moon of falling leaves, according to the Arapaho way of marking the passing time. The meeting in Eagle Hall behind the administration building had ended 20 minutes ago, but he'd stayed on until the members of the planning committee had shrugged into bulky jackets and one by one filed out into the pale gray light of evening, coaxed a line of old pickups and sedans into life, and bumped around Circle Drive toward 17 Mile Road. By then, Father Damien Henley, the new assistant priest, had already left. Past the museum windows, Father John could see the blurred figures moving about in the gallery. Normal closing time was 8 o'clock, but the Edward S. Curtis exhibit on the Plains Indians that opened 2 weeks ago had brought a steady stream of visitors who seemed to lose themselves in the century-old photographs of Arapahos, Cheyennes, Pagan, Crow, and Sioux. He veered left, taking a shortcut through the frost-stiffened wild grasses in the center of the mission. Christine Nelson, the new curator, might need some help closing up tonight. He bounded up the steps to the porch that extended across the front of the stone building. The floorboards creaked under his boots. The moment he let himself through the oversized wooden door, he heard the voices buzzing like an electric current from the gallery on the left. He glanced through the doorway of what had once been a classroom. A group of Arapahos, students, he guessed, by the notebooks clutched in their hands and the earnest way they bent their heads in discussion, clustered around a middle-aged white man who looked like a professor with tortoise-shell glasses and a mass of gray curly hair that dipped over his forehead like a fur cap, and in back was caught in a ponytail. One of the girls looked familiar, the shiny black hair that hung down her back, the narrow, pretty face with prominent cheekbones. And it had been a while since he'd seen Hiram Bluefeather and Roy Glick. 3 years ago, they'd been skinny kids playing for the Eagles, the baseball team that he'd started his first summer at St. Francis. With Hiram on the pitcher's mound and Roy behind the plate, the Eagles had brought home the district championship. Arranged along the walls were the black-and-white Curtis photographs that glowed with tones of pink and gold under the overhead fluorescent lights. A couple of the students had wandered over to the far wall, where 11 photographs that Curtis had taken of Arapahoes were displayed. Fewer images than the photographer had made of other Plains tribes, as if he hadn't spent much time on the reservation. And the photographs were smaller than the large photogravure images that Curtis had selected for his portfolios, no more than 7 by 9 inches. Still, they were beautiful. But it was the photograph in the center of the wall that drew Father John's attention each time he came to the museum. 3 warriors riding down a mountainside, rifles and feathered headdresses silhouetted against the clear, open sky. A small village below, canvas teepees shining in the sunlight. A normal day. People in the village going about their chores. Women cooking and scraping hides. Men standing about, visiting with one another. One man was having his hair combed by a woman who bent over him, her back curved in gentleness. Another man was cleaning his rifle. The photograph was titled, Before the Attack. The group of students had clustered in front of the photograph, everyone talking at once, voices low and intense, the gray ponytail nodding, encouraging. A girl with shiny black hair reached out and swept her hand across the image of the warriors, as if she might wipe them out of the picture and protect the village. We can all agree that the photograph is powerful. The woman's voice behind him was tight with exasperation. Father John looked around. Christine Nelson stood outside the office on the other side of the entry, arms folded across the front of her navy blue turtleneck sweater. She was small and fine-boned, probably in her late 30s, and attractive in a brittle kind of way. She had dark, straight-cut hair that hung to her shoulders and framed a pale, oval face, whose most distinguishing features were the light, watchful eyes and the red-tinged lips drawn into a tight line. She had on slacks that matched her sweater and diamond earrings that flickered through her hair when she moved her head. Maybe you can get them to stop yammering. Agree that the photographs are magnificent and get out of here, she said as he walked toward her. They can argue all they want in class. I was about to throw them out. Care to do the honors? She pulled back the cuff of her sweater and glanced at a gold-banded watch. I have an appointment in 20 minutes. I'll be glad to close up, Father John said. In that case, I'll be on my way. The woman checked her watch again, then swung into the office and plucked a briefcase from the desk. After grabbing a coat from somewhere behind the door, she emerged into the entry, grasping the coat and briefcase against her chest. They're all yours, she said, throwing a look of irritation toward the gallery before she let herself outside. A gust of cold air blew through the entry as the door swooshed shut. Hey, Father! Father John turned back to the gallery. Hiram was beckoning him forward. Settle a debate for us. What do you say? The young man lifted one hand toward the village. You think Curtis staged this photograph? Created his own little village? Enacted the attack? Like he was directing a movie in 1907? This from the girl with long, shiny hair. Father John started toward the students, aware of the thud of his boots on the old wood floor and the eyes fastened on him. For a moment, he felt like the American history teacher he'd once been in a Jesuit prep school, student eyes following him as he paced the front of the class, searching for the logical answer to a question, the answer that seemed to make the most sense out of the past. He stopped next to Hiram and studied the photo. The Indian battles were over, and the villages were gone by the late 1890s, when Curtis began taking his photographs, he said. Curtis wanted to document Indian traditions, so he created scenes that he thought depicted traditional life. A legitimate documentary technique. The man with the gray ponytail looked from one student to the other, then turned to Father John and thrust out a mitt-sized hand with a grip of steel. Don Cannon, Father. I teach the film classes at Central Wyoming College. True, Curtis paid Indians to stage scenes such as mock battles. After all, he worked in the pictorial style popular at the time. But let's not lose sight of the man's artistry. Keep in mind that he used a Primo camera, very advanced technology then, with its reversible back capable of either horizontal or vertical shots. Exposure time was as fast as 1/100th of a second, so he could shoot pictures as fast as his assistant could load new plates into the camera. Still primitive technology by our standards. Nevertheless, Curtis managed to get images with so much clarity and detail that the scenes might be taking place before our eyes, which gives them a power that's almost magical, he said. When we look at them, it's as if we are transported into the past. I don't call it a legitimate technique, the girl said. How else could Curtis have photographed an enemy attack? Hiram locked eyes with Roy, and both young men nodded. The girl's chin jutted forward. Curtis could have admitted that he staged the scenes, like rolling the credits at the end of a film. Then we'd know what we're seeing. But he presents the photograph as if enemy warriors were about to attack an actual village. What do the rest of you think about Miriam's point? Cannon asked. Ah, Miriam Redshield, Father John thought. Eunice Redshield's granddaughter, the small girl with black braids. How long ago? Squirming in the front pew next to her grandmother at the 10 o'clock Sunday Mass. The others were shaking their heads in unison, like soldiers in a drill. Hiram's right, Roy said. Curtis recreated the scene like a documentary. He wanted us to experience what it was like in the village before enemy warriors attacked and people died. But that's not what happened. Miriam's face tightened, and for a moment Father John thought she might burst into tears. It was the warriors who died. She had everyone's attention now. Well, obviously, some of the enemy might die in an attack, Cannon said. All of them died. Miriam lifted her chin and stared at the warriors riding down slope, zigzags of paint crossing their faces and naked chests like streaks of lightning. She seemed transfixed, as if the photograph had yielded some meaning to her that had eluded everyone else. What are you saying? Father John asked. The girl kept her gaze on the photograph. Grandmother said the warriors were killed. She tapped the glass over the image of the warrior on the right, a forelock of black hair bunched over his forehead, black eyes narrowed in determination, the faintest mark of dimples in his cheeks. He was her grandfather. He was called Thunder. Your grandmother identified one of the warriors? This was good news. Father John felt a familiar surge of excitement, the same feeling that used to come over him when he was doing research in some archives and stumbled upon an obscure fact, the key to the puzzle that made everything else fall into place. "Does your grandmother have a photograph of Thunder?" he asked the girl. She shrugged. That's what the curator asked her. All grandmother said was, "I guess I know my own grandfather." The other students had started talking all at once, and Cannon put up a fleshy hand to quiet them. "I'm not following," he said. "Why would anyone have died if it was staged?" The girl remained silent for a long moment, her gaze still fastened on the photograph. Finally she said, "Grandmother told me that after Curtis came, the warriors in the photo all died, and it was real hard on the families. That's what her father told her." It was several minutes before the group began drifting down the gallery, reluctance in the way they moved toward the entry, as if the photograph still exerted an invisible pull, drawing them back to the past. Father John followed them out and told them to come back any time. "You can count on that," Cannon said, as Father John closed the door. He walked back into the gallery and snapped off the overhead lights. The photograph shone in the glow of moonlight filtering through the windows. He could almost sense the fear pulsing through the village, the shock and panic as the warriors galloped toward the teepees, shouting, firing rifles overhead. "Thunder," he said out loud, the sound of his voice coming back in the stillness of the empty room. "What happened that day, Thunder?"